Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 14-472, Gold Coast Neighborhood Association v. State. Arguing for the petitioner, William J. Weinhoff. Arguing for respondents, Robert G. Klein. Also appearing for respondents, Jordan J. Kimura. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Weinhoff, Mr. Klein, and Mr. Kimura. Are you all ready to proceed today?
Yes, sir.
All right. Mr. Weinhoff, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, but you've asked that the warning light come on with 15 minutes to go, and we will do that for you if that's what you'd like.
Sure.
And we'll have a warning light for you, Mr. Klein, with 5 minutes to go in your arm.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bill William Weinhoff. I am the Deputy Attorney General, and I'm representing the State of Hawaii in this case. May it please the Court. I hope that I will be able to discuss with you briefly the three points that I've raised in our writ of certiorari. The first point is, what is the meaning of the statutory scheme relating to this taken as a whole? The second part is, who are the proper parties in this case, the necessary parties in this case? And the third is the application of, should the state in fact end up as the not prevailing party, the application of the doctrine of private attorney general doctrine and sovereign immunity under the circumstances of this case. I'd like to first address the statutory scheme. And when I say scheme, I mean that advisedly in the sense that there are four statutes that the state contends are relevant. The underlying statute is 264.1, which is a very interesting and, in fact, unique part of Hawaiian history in 1892, at a time when the islands were still a kingdom. The legislature at that time passed, and Queen Liliuokalani approved the so-called Highways Act of 1892. The Highways Act of 1892 really has three parts, one of which is, it said that roads that were in existence at that time were owned by the state. There was only one entity at that time, no counties yet, which is an important point.
How do you explain the part of 264-1C that state that allows, that mandates that the legislative body of the county has to adopt the county, but doesn't address any requirement by the state in order to assert ownership?
Thank you, Honor. That's a very good question. And I'm going to just jump directly to that because I know you guys probably, of course, you already know the background of the act. And so that is an interesting question and an important question, one that I posited and raised for the proposition that adopting the state's position would not be an absurd interpretation, because if the county has the authority to say yes or no, then certainly it seems to us is not absurd for the state to have to say it. But the question that Your Honor asked is, why is it in the statute that the county specifically specifically gives them the right to say yes or no in that statute, and does not specifically give the state in that statute the right to say yes or no? First of all, historically, because I think that is relevant. In 1892, when the law was first passed, as you know, it did say that the Department of Interior had to say yes or no. In 1925, there was an amendment to the statute, and at that point it said that the that was Act 48 in 1905. I misspoke. In 1905, Chapter 48 codified the Highways Act. At that time, it had been changed to say that the superintendent of highways had to, provided that the same shall be accepted or adopted by the superintendent of public works, right? In 1945, as far as I've been able to tell, in 1945 is when that language came out. And the reason, getting directly to your question, Your Honor, there's two points. In 1945, the act was, I have it right in front of me, I'm sorry, but in 1945, the law, at that point it said, it was codified in sections 611.11 et sec. And what it said is, at that time it said, 6112 said the ownership of all public highways shall be in the government in fee simple, responding, so let me just take a moment to think rather than talk.
Pardon me. Well, is your argument that it's a mistake? That it's not there?
In brief, I wouldn't say a mistake. What I'm getting at is that in 1945, this is actually part of a much larger problem, and that is who is the owner of all roads in Limbo. For example, there was a 1989 report by the Legislative Reference Bureau that talked about the legislative response to the issue of what happened when the counties were created. And in that legislative, what happened is the county, the state, the legislature, pardon me, as of 1945, said that all of these roads were county roads. And so therefore, when in 1945 they put in the Bureau of Supervisors has to have the authority to say yes, then that covered all of the roads, because at that time the law said, the Highways Act said, that all roads would be county roads. And so they took it out. And then when there became, to the extent there's actually the Legislative Reference Bureau, and an argument could be made that all roads and trails are county trails, because as you know, 264-1 says all roads are county roads except to the extent they're in the state highway system. So arguably, the county owns this road. So I would say, in answer to Justice Nakayama's question, which I'm still working on, I have another part to the answer. In answer to your question, Justice Pollack, I don't think it was a mistake. I think it was based on the assumption that all of these roads were county roads. So that would be my first answer to it. And my second answer to the question is that
even... How does that square with subsection 1 then?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Subsection 1 talks about the Director of Transportation.
Yeah.
And the Board of Land and Natural Resources. We have state entities that are discussed in subsection 1 and not in subsection 2, 264.1. So are we talking that...
Yes, of course that's true, Your Honor. So I'm just saying, the argument that we are making is that historically, it has been... Historically, there's been an issue with respect to whether any of these roads were county roads or any were state roads. Clearly, some of them are state roads. But this is, on the other hand, this is not a road that's been accepted as part of the state highway system. And so the 264 refers to roads that are not part of the state highway system would otherwise be roads. And so there is, my suggestion on this first argument is simply that there has been a historical confusion for decades as to what is a county road and what is a state road.
So just to kind of drop through the cracks. The bottom line of your position is that you don't believe the legislature deleting the reference to the state accepting the roads, it reflected an intent to not require state acceptance. Is that kind of the bottom line of the state's position?
Well, as the ICA determined in, or ruled in the Santos case, I think that was my argument specifically, is that in deleting that phrase and changing it around, that does not reflect a conscious decision by the legislature to say that the county has the right to say no, but the state does not have the right to say no. And I also, that's with respect to that statute standing by itself, that's the argument. Is historically speaking, there are reasons for that other than a conscious decision to give the county the right to say no, and a conscious decision that the state could not say yes. There's nothing in the legislative history that reflects anything like that. And my second point, and my second argument on the point, is that, and that's, this is getting back to why I called it a scheme in the first place. I don't mean to be pejorative on that. You have four statutes that deal with this particular issue, the particular issue being whether or not the state has the right to say no. One statute, 264-1, doesn't say anything, although absolutely correct, Justice Pollack and other members of the court, the argument that it says it specifically deals with the county and does not specifically deal with the state, that certainly could give rise to the inference or the argument that that's what they consciously meant. But I submit the fact that there are three other statutes that specifically say how it is that the state obtains any interest in real property, those statutes should be read in peri materia should all be read together, and we submit that the way to reconcile them is to simply say, another way to look at it is there wouldn't be any reason for the state, and again, there's nothing reflecting this in the legislative history, but there really isn't any reason.
Mr. Weinhoff, let's say the state has the right to say no.
Yes.
But shouldn't the state have said no back in 1982, 84, 93, 2003,
yes,
all those times when the state made repairs to the seawall?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's another very good question. And actually, I hope that in deciding this case, the justices of this honorable court will keep that distinction in mind, because there's a very big distinction between saying the state never has a chance to say no, and between saying, okay, they had the chance to say no, and they failed to accept it, that chance in this case, okay? And so I hope that you'll keep that in mind. I think that the state, because that is, I mean, it's very important going forward, is it that the state never can say no? Now,
but,
with
but
respect-
But the argument is, and I think that's what is being referred to, is the state repeatedly through the years has said, it's our conclusion that the state has the responsibility. I mean,
absolutely. And I'm just about to address our question. I think it's a very good question, and thank you for reiterating it. I wasn't trying to duck it. I just wanted to make that point first. So, again, our argument is, and our position is looking at the statutes themselves, and particularly 107-10, just paragrammatically 107-10, no real property or any right, et cetera, without the prior approval of the Attorney General.
And as so, to form.
That's right, what,
as to form exceptions and reservations.
Yes, Your Honor. There's,
it sounds
there's,
to
there's,
me like when there's a document. We
okay,
don't have a document.
There's another point there, so I'm going to address that one too. I appreciate that that exists. And let me address the first one, though. With respect to the history that we've had of saying we worked on it, we did this negative declaration that says we own it, we have the duty to do it. I submit that that is exactly the situation that these statutes are intended to address. There is no action by the Board of Land and Natural Resources that endorses the actions of its staff and says this. There's no action, no determination by the Attorney General himself or herself, as it may have been at the time.
But what about Mr. Weatherwax and his opinion letter from 1975? That said, they
his opinion letter,
for a portion of the seawall.
Yes, that's true, and I think it could be construed that way. I guess what I would say, Your Honor, with respect, and I think this certainly isn't the best case that we have, but I would suggest that these statutes are designed to do exactly to avoid exactly the problem that we have in this case. People at staff level, people at my level, I don't think I have the right to say the state accepts this thing. I don't know, and there's nothing in the record that shows that the Attorney General endorsed what Mr. Weatherwax did.
I have a few factual questions. I'm a little bit confused by some of the facts in this case. So
I'll
in terms of, I'm going to call it the seawall, but I understand that there might be several. Is that right?
They were all built at different times. There was some squabbling.
Are they all attached?
They're all contiguous.
Okay.
Yes.
So in terms of the seawalls, seawall here,
okay,
are they included within meets and bounds of the TMKs?
To some extent.
To some extent, but some are not.
Well, let me just take a sort of a paradigmatic. It is actually really complicated, and the best way to really understand it would be to look at Exhibit J24. Which actually wasn't even included in your record, but it would be possible to study it. And so what you have is, you have most of these things were originally granted way back at the Mahele Makekai, you know, so obviously
right
by the sea. At some point, at least one of the sets of property was registered in the land court, and there were meets and bounds, and there were also some deeds that had the deeds in the regular system tend to say something like the following, which is, the seaward boundary is along the ocean, the meets and bounds of which are as follows. So we do have seaward meets and bounds for some but not all of the property. The walls, so the walls to some extent are built makai of those meets and bounds. And to the extent that they are makai of the meets and bounds, Our contention is that they are encroaching. And our contention is, and I think this is absolutely clear in the law, that if you go and build a wall on your neighbor's property that encroaches onto his property, that doesn't mean that you then own that wall or have the duty to maintain it.
Did you build some of those? Did you build some of those walls on the Mackay? You actually, in some of these constructions that Judge Castaneda just referred to, you actually in the rebuild built at Mackay, and now you're claiming that it's.
We built one wall, Mackay, in front of the Diamond Head Ambassador Hotel, and we have admitted in our pleadings that because we built it on our property, we own it.
Okay, so the seawalls are all Makekai? Or no, are some of them included? Is any part of the seawall included in meets and bounds Land Court property, or is this all Land Court property?
All Land Court property. Okay. The two or three lots at the end. But the answer to your question is yes.
They're all, the seawalls are included within the meets and bounds of the TMKs.
So let me try to be a little more clear. I apologize, Your Honor. In the most instances, the walls are, some are Mauka, part of the wall is Mauka of the meets and bounds, and part is Mackay of the meets and bounds.
Okay. So to the ones that are, the seawalls are Mauka of the meets and bounds.
Yes, Your Honor.
The question I have is 2641C2, no act of ownership by the owner. Okay, no act of ownership. Was there ever any argument raised as to whether or not payment of real property taxes is an act of ownership?
Yes, we made that argument.
And was that addressed in the findings?
No, I don't believe it's in the findings, but I could be wrong.
So the state did argue that payment of real property taxes is an act of ownership.
Yes, and it does not show up in the argument. I can't tell you exactly where in the record it is, and I did not make that argument on appeal.
So okay. The other question I have, factual question I have, is it's kind of unclear to me. So there were some owners that were originally included and some dropped out.
Yes,
and
sure.
So are all of the owners of this entire length of this contiguous seawall included as either members of GCNA or as defendants in the state's action?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
In the findings, and it's on page 4 of the findings. I can't give you an actual record, so I apologize. But on page 4 of the findings of fact, as I believe it's that page, I'll make sure I look at it when it's my
so some there, owners of the
there
sea-
is a map.
Okay.
And what it shows is there's 11 properties. One property is isolated by itself, and the other 10 are next to each other.
So all of the owners of this seawall area are not parties.
Correct, Your Honor.
And they're okay. Does this case then decide that the entire seawall is a trail that has been surrendered to the state?
No, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
No.
It only decides as to those portions.
Right. One of the arguments that I made below, and I didn't push on certiorari, was that it wasn't a trail in the first place because you can't get to it and it doesn't go anywhere.
So my question is, that's my other question.
Yes.
On the Waikiki side, I understand I didn't understand the terminology. I understand on the Waikiki side, all right, so is the first owner of that, the beginning of the seawall, a party to this case? Assuming that it is, okay?
Okay, yeah.
Is there a sign there that says
Go ahead,
private property, no trespassing?
Yes. That's the first owner is the one that says that. Yes.
So why is that not an act of ownership?
Well, I think that's a good question. I argued that.
How do you access the trail?
I believe the argument that will be made, I probably should let them make it, but I believe the argument will be is that that sign is supposed to indicate that you're not supposed to go Mauka of the wall. I don't think that's how people read it when you go by there, but I believe that's the argument.
But you can access the wall from the ocean, correct?
Yeah, some of them you can. Some of them you cannot because they're literally 6 feet above the walls.
Right.
But if you were to swim up, it would be possible in some of the instances for you to climb on the wall. And, in fact, there's a sea ladder. that you could climb out of if you wanted to.
The sea ladder, is that the one that the state issued the permit?
Yes, and I want to just make sure
that... Is that the wall that you constructed?
We didn't give a permit for the wall. We gave a permit for this for the submerged area. So that's what the easement is for. And that, I mean, that I don't know why that's been a source of confusion, and I know why for you, because I didn't explain it to you before. But we didn't give a permit for the wall. We gave a right of entry or easement or whatever for the submerged land, so that there's some land below it that you could get into. If I might, may I circle back to Justice Pollack's question? Justice Pollack, you had asked some questions about the specifics of...
Do you want to silence your phone, please? Thank you. Please proceed with your argument.
I thought I did, and I apologize to the court.
No, that's fine. Proceed with your argument.
Justice Pollack, you had asked me some questions about the specifics of one of the statutes that I pointed out, and correctly you said, as to form exceptions and reservations. And each of those, and that argument, so then, certainly could be argued to say, well, it means that only if there was an actual grant to the state. Again, Your Honor, what I would say, Your Honor, is that we have three statutes here. And if we were to ask ourselves, in passing these three statutes, what has the legislature actually tried to do? I submit to you that what they've tried to do in three different statutes is to make sure that exactly what happened here doesn't happen. They've used very broad language, and it seems to me...
So is there any room for common law doctrines in this case, or is there any common law doctrine of dedication or implied easement that's left?
Yes, Your Honor, but,
alive after if your position's adopted?
Yes, Your Honor. And with respect to that, the ICA to some extent relied on that, but what both at the lower court and at the ICA, the argument with respect to prescriptive easements, for example, was taken from the Jones case, which is a federal case. For the reasons that I've stated, we don't believe that Jones fully or completely stated the law of prescriptive easements. When you have a prescriptive easement, it needs to be open, notorious, hostile, continuous. Every presumption is made against losing the property. And what we found in this case and what the findings of fact show is there's no evidence as to whether the use was permissive. In our argument, Your Honor, when we said that should be the end of the case.
Could you repeat that again? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear your comment before.
The finding or conclusion was that there's no evidence as to whether the public's use was permissive. I agree. Nobody could figure out what happened. I mean, it was very difficult for us to put on evidence as to what happened in the 50s. The only person who said was this June Anderson, and there was simply no evidence as to whether the use was permissive.
And what
that should have been the end of the case with respect to that, since there's no evidence that's permissive.
In this case, it is GCNA that is asking for a prescriptive easement to be recognized?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Is it GCNA that is requesting, the homeowners are requesting a prescriptive easement?
Well,
is that the situation?
I'm going to say yes, but I'd just like to say that what they asked for is they asked for an order that we have to repair the property, and then it turned out that, well, why would we have to repair the property only because we owned it or had an easement? So that's a long answer to your question.
Right, and it was actually your deck action that said we want a ruling that we don't have an easement and we don't own it, correct?
Right. Right.
But in any event, the court did find a prescriptive easement?
Yes,
okay. My question is, there were various theories on which the trial court ruled, from what I can see. A prescriptive easement and implied?
The question is, when Judge Hefo ruled on the motion for summary, the cross motions for summary judgment, the very first sitting in the case, she came down an order that said there's two issues remaining that can be tried. One is implied dedication, and the other one was surrender. And those are the two issues that we...
Implied dedication and what?
Implied dedication.
And
surrender pursuant to 264. So I take that to mean, circling back to Justice Rechtenwald's question, that implied dedication was the common law doctrine. In the ICA's decision, there was an interesting conflation, it seemed to me, between implied dedication and prescriptive easement. I wasn't sure which exactly way they were going, undoubtedly my failing. But
But our court has recognized implied dedication.
It has recognized implied dedication. Yes, we've talked about it, Your Honor. That's true.
And that's what the court found.
I agree, Your Honor, and that's what, and my arguments are exactly the same with respect to implied dedication, but which is because of the statutes, the state cannot simply be given one of these roads or trails or seawalls without its consent.
But that means, I mean, implied dedication includes, in fact, I think Dan talked about implied dedication and implied acceptance. Your argument is taking out half the theory, because your argument is saying, oh, we have these statutes which Banning didn't cite.
Yeah.
Which seem to me more ministerial kind of statutes in any event.
But Banning actually started off with a holding that the implied dedication theory is inconsistent with 520-1 and 520-7.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we brought that up, that issue up here too, and Judge Crandall, to her credit, did address that.
And then it went on to say, you know, we did recognize implied dedication in King versus Cornwell,
right.
But it's not met here.
Right, that's true.
Was that ruling actually necessary?
No, Your Honor.
So in terms of 520-7, I'm very interested in this case because these owners want the state to want this to be deemed an easement. And/or the state, it's been surrendered, I guess.
I would say yes, except for keep in mind that they're not the owners, but yes, they want us to have the duty to maintain and the owners.
Right, it's really for maintenance purposes.
Yes.
And so this could really open this up statewide.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what we're concerned about.
If, however, the basis for one of her rulings was that you can call it adverse possession, you can call it prescriptive easement, but what we have in this situation, which is very unusual, is that the state from 1975 to 2006 said, wait a minute, this is our wall for all essential purposes. We are going to repair it when we want to repair it. We are not asking the owners for permission. We're just going to go ahead and do it. And then all of a sudden in 2007, they said, oh, we changed our mind.
You're right, Your Honor. I think it is unusual. I hope it is unusual. And I talked about that briefly before in the sense of I think this is exactly the kind of thing that the statutes are designed to avoid. If, however, you do go down that route, then I would, we would say that the court should carefully think about the ramifications going forward. And if this case can be cabined within those outlines, that would be great. May I briefly address the
attorney's fees?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So, Your Honor, I think I kind of feel as though I did have the opportunity to brief it pretty well, and at least as well as I was able to. And so I welcome questions. But my feeling, our position is clearly on their own lawsuit. It's absolutely clear from your precedents that they would not be entitled to private attorney general doctrine fees. And so the question becomes, and this is what the ICA said: sovereign immunity is not applicable because we brought our own lawsuit.
Well.
I mean, I guess that is, in fact, sort of technically right, as I said. But nevertheless, it's not applicable as to the lawsuit. But your decisions, your precedents have also made very clear that there has to be a separate waiver of sovereign immunity for the private attorney general doctrine fees. For example, if we were to file a lawsuit that said someone crashed their car into the Supreme Court building, it cost $100,000 worth of damages, and we're suing you for damages in tort, and we were to lose, well, we're not entitled, the losing party, the defendant would then not be entitled to private attorney general doctrine fees because there's no waiver of sovereign immunity with respect to the fees themselves. So, Your Honor, I tried to reserve some of my time. I'm sure I've already gone well over. I appreciate your courtesy, unless there's any other questions that I could address before I sit down. Thank you very much.
I do have a quick question.
Yes, Your Honor.
If this is your state's easement and or the state's owns portions or all of the seawall, by the way, was there a determination that you actually owned it? The state,
yes,
actually. Okay. Could the state abandon the easement?
Your Honor, I'm going to say the answer to that question is yes, and there have in fact been serious discussions in the Department of Land and Natural Resources as to whether our response would be to.
Because Levi versus Kemble.
Tear down the wall.
Levi versus Kemble, one yes. of the things that's stated in there, and I think that case is really different because it was
yes.
who there was an explicit easement
right.
and it dealt with who's responsible for the tort right. liability.
Right.
But one of the things that it said toward the end was, you know, the state could have done various things like putting up signs or closing it.
That's certainly a possibility, Your Honor. If it's our wall, then either, presumably, either the legislature is going to appropriate millions of dollars to fix it, or we're going to have to close it down. I mean, we're going to have to give some.
Because the real purpose of this wall is to protect these properties
yes,
against
honor.
Erosion.
Yeah, that's a stipulated fact.
It's right.
Part of their complaint. Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And so I'm wondering if the owners have completely thought through the implications of foisting or requesting that the state own
yes,
this property.
I have thought that myself.
And that's certainly, I would think, that argument, although I think Justice McKenna is considering it for one light, that would certainly be an argument, it would seem to me, that would weigh as to the attorney fees if, in fact, the wall could be torn down or the easement actually, the trail being blocked. Certainly there would not be the broad benefit to the public that the private attorney general doctrine
right.
requires.
Well, I would hope, as you know, that we wouldn't get to actually weighing the factors, but you're right. Otherwise, you're right with respect to that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Weinhoff, we did ask you a number of questions during the time you reserved for rebuttal, and I will give you some additional time to rebut.
As always, I appreciate it, Your Honor. Thank
very
you.
Mr. Klein.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice,
morning.
Members of the court, and please the court. I'm Robert Klein representing the, appellees, defendants in this case, as well as plaintiffs, Gold Coast Neighborhood Association. Before I get into my introduction, I thought I'd tackle that last question first about abandonment. When the state ends up owning the wall, could they simply walk away from it and let erosion knock down the structure? Number one, as a landowner adjacent to buildings, you have responsibilities to those other structures.
I've looked at lateral and substantial support, but yes. It seems like the lateral support issue, it seems like it only applies to unnatural acts. In other words, excavation or subterranean excavation. So it doesn't seem to apply to natural acts.
The seawall, if it were removed by the state, it's certainly not. It would be an act intent by the state to take the wall down so that the lateral support could be.
What about it? Yeah, what if it abandons it? What if it puts signs up saying no thoroughfare danger, you know, nobody walks on this, we're not maintaining it?
I think we could do that now.
That actually does go through to the first question. What of that sign apparently that appears on the first property, no
very
trespassing,
simply,
private property?
That very simply, that sign is to prevent people from trespassing on the Mauka portion that's actually owned by the
and property. I'm not familiar with it. I couldn't find it in the record. Where exactly is it?
It's in a finding of fact.
I know. Where is the sign?
Pardon me?
Where is the sign physically
located?
In
front located? Of the tropic seas. So it's to prevent people from who are accessing the walkway on the seawall from migrating into their property.
That's how do you address the issue of the trail as to if all of the owners all are not part of this case? How many of the properties are actually, where is the public entrance to this trail?
Public can enter in a variety of ways. The findings of fact indicate exactly where.
Lot A, which is actually only for the owners of, what is it, the Diamond Head Terrace?
Your Honor, we have testimony that's unrefuted in this case about surfers who, from the time he was 10 years old, accessed the seawall specifically so that he could.
Through Lot A? Just curious, through Lot A?
Yes.
Okay.
And traversed the entire seawall from the time he was 10, and he's now in his 50s. So they go to the three prime surf breaks right off the seawall. And, you know, getting back to this issue of abandonment, there is, if you look at 264 2D, it says all county public highways and trails once established shall continue until vacated, closed, abandoned, or discontinued by a resolution of the legislative body of the county wherein the county highway or trail lies. All state trails once established shall continue until lawfully disposed of pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 171.
Right.
So it's not an automatic where they can just walk away. You have to go to the DLNR and under Chapter 171 proceed to do that. Because obviously when you eliminate a trail of long standing, there are consequences.
Did the state argue that payment of real property taxes is an act of ownership?
No. In fact...
So that was a misrepresentation?
I believe it is, because, Your Honor, the state does not contest the underlying facts. Judge Crandall made a whole series of facts. The state does not contest them. All the state is saying is you need our consent, even if the doctrine of implied dedication applies or surrender under the statute applies. Then, as Mr. Weinhoff says, you have to read the statutes in pari materia. He offers three statutes, and he says that those apply on top of the requirements of 264-1 and 2 and 3. There has never been a case, Your Honor, during the long history of these statutes being on the books since statehood, where that proposition of law has been upheld, not one. And we have Banning. In Banning, there's a complete discussion of the doctrine of implied dedication. The court did not say, we reject the idea of implied dedication because there are certain statutes that deal with it, DLNR and its ability to obtain or acquire property by dedication.
They said it was too not long enough.
It said several things, Your Honor. It said the time was not long enough, the easement was not adequately described. It went through the elements of implied dedication, found them all lacking under the facts of that particular case, but did not reject the doctrine of implied dedication, and more importantly, did not say, and there are several statutes you would have to follow also and apply them in pari materia, as Mr. Weinhoff suggests.
But before discussing implied easement, yes, by dedication, this court clearly discussed 520-7, saying, you know, it implied dedication theory inconsistent with recreational, you know, purpose of the chapter is to encourage owners of land to make land and water areas available to the public for recreational use.
Yes.
And it says no person shall gain any rights to any land by prescription or otherwise as a result of any usage thereof for recreational. So this court, I think, had already held that for purposes of this, this was this oceanfront also? I can't remember.
Yes.
Oceanfront. We're not going to recognize this concept.
Yes.
And then it went on to say, well, we do have this concept of implied prescription easement by dedication, but it doesn't apply anyway because the time period isn't met.
Your Honor,
but the first holding was 520-7. We don't think implied easements by dedication should be allowed in waterfront recreational areas because that discourages owners from allowing people to traverse their property, which is something we want to encourage.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that statute is there because of liability. You know, you don't want people who allow the public onto their property, right, to incur liability when they keep the property open, because what they'll do is shut it down, like Mr. Weinhoff suggests the state would do. They would shut it down because they want people injured on their property or recreating on the property. In this case, as Judge Crandall found, the so-called owners of this easement or this property actually want people to use. And that's the whole point of this case. They want people to be able to access the wall without liability. It's consistent with the doctrine, and that statute didn't come into effect until 1969, long before the implied dedication of this property made it state property. So And if you look at carefully at Judge Crandall's findings of facts, and I'm sure you have, and conclusions of law, which were validated for the most part by the ICA, you'll find because the state doesn't challenge the findings of facts or the conclusions of law, except to the extent they didn't take into account the three statutes that Mr. Winehouse said should be taken account of.
Isn't there something else about Banning? When Banning rejected it and talking about it, it said the implied dedication theory set forth in GION, was talking about it, was rejecting that theory.
Exactly.
But it did not reject the implied dedication theory. In fact, it applied it and said, look, it's not a highway in this case, number one, it's an accretion, and number two, it's not long enough. But in no way does it not say that the implied dedication theory that had been a part of Hawaii law for over 100 years didn't continue to exist.
Exactly, Your Honor. I totally agree with you.
And let me just point out one other thing, because this is something that, to me, I don't understand how an argument can be made that implied dedication under 264.1 requires that that we have to have the board involved for implied dedication, because the statute itself says if you're doing a regular designation, then the Board of Land and Natural Resources is involved. So to require an implied dedication would just turn it on, it just doesn't make sense, actually.
Exactly. I totally agree with you.
Mr. Klein, can you address Mr. Weinhoff's argument about all necessary parties not being included?
Well, that's what Mr. Weinhoff thought, which is why he filed his own lawsuit, to make sure all the parties were here. I think possibly because he thought that if he won, he wanted a complete victory, and he didn't want the other parties who were not part of this case to file their own separate lawsuits. You can ask him.
The condominium associations are now included?
Every one of the 11 parcels who abut the seawall that are necessary for a decision in this case are part of this case, either because we made them part of the case or because the state made them part of the case. That has really never been an issue in this case, and he didn't ask for cert because of that, I'm fairly sure. But, getting back to Banning, I think the interesting part about Banning, Justice Pollack, is where the Supreme Court says the state contends that it has an easement for public access along a shoreline trail whenever the owner fails to exercise acts of ownership over it and has acquiesced in the public use of it for more than 5 years, citing 264.1. The state didn't take the position that, well, you need the other three statutes as well. In fact, the state has never, until you can look for any case in Hawaii that isn't designated Gold Coast, and you won't find the state ever making that argument. That's a brand new argument. And I think the reason, if you look at the statutes, as you suggest, if you look at the three statutes that he mentions, one of which shouldn't even be in the record, because they didn't put it into the record in compliance with 28J, put it into the record after the brief was filed, even though that statute had been on the books since 1959. Anyway, if you look at all three statutes, you find that they are ministerial in nature. You know, if there's a document that is a conveyance document, then the AG has to approve it. Sure, but it doesn't say what they do when there isn't a document. And it says, it says that the DLNR
doesn't it say the Board of Land and Natural Resources shall have exclusive responsibility of acquiring, including by way of dedication. Now that he argues that reflects a very sweeping purpose that the board has to be involved and approve. What's your response to that?
My response to that, Your Honor, is it might take a second to do this, but if looking at this statute, it was amended in 1988 because Santos was such a confusing case that the legislature actually said, we have to extricate trails and rights of way from the broad scope of Santos. And Judge Crandall examined this to some extent. And so the legislature took trails and rights of way out of that, and what did it say? It created 264.1b, which says, all trails and other non-vehicular rights of way in the state declared to be public rights of way by the Highways Act, open, laid out, or built by the government, or otherwise created, or vested as non-vehicular public rights away at any time thereafter or in the future are declared to be public trails. A public trail under the jurisdiction of the State Board of Land and Natural Resources, a public trail is under the jurisdiction of the State Board of Land and Natural Resources unless it was created or dedicated to a particular county, in which case it falls under the jurisdiction of the county. So once you have a trail or a non-vehicular right-of-way created, it is under the administration of the DLNR. In other words, it becomes a state trail or non-vehicular right-of-way.
What about Mr. Weinhoff's argument that it's not a trail because it doesn't go anywhere?
It does go somewhere. If I'm a surfer and I enter the seawall with my surfboard and want to surf at rice bowls, I walk down the wall, I get in the water with my board, and I go surfing. His example was, if you look at the Holly Kalani case in Jones, well, she was coming from the Hilton Hawaiian after a picnic, walking to her hotel room, so that's why it's a trail. Well, everybody who accesses a wall is going somewhere. They're not sitting on the trail to have a picnic lunch. They're going from point A to point B, just as the example in Holly Kalani. Of course it's a trail. It's a non-vehicular right-of-way. And if it's a trail, and it complies with 264.1b, then it is under the jurisdiction of the DLNR. That is their acceptance and approval, and that's what Mr. Weinhoff says, you know, well, you have to have the three statutes. How do you square having three statutes with a statutory requirement that the trail, once established, already is under the Department of Land and Natural Resources?
Mr. Klein, I'm looking at the three complaints that you filed, the amended complaints, and all of them, you said the state has a duty to maintain in good and safe condition a long stretch of seawall. And when you go through the court's findings, the court carefully reaches a conclusion that there's either a prescriptive easement or there's a right-of-way or surrender implied dedication. But then all of a sudden at the very end, and it just comes up in the order, it says the state owns the seawall. How do you go from being required to maintain the top of the seawall to suddenly owning it? It didn't even seem like that's what you were asking.
Our theory was there are two bases upon which the state had responsibility for the seawall. Number one, implied dedication, which we've covered. Number two, surrender. If you look at the surrender statute, this entire seawall property and the land they're under, by surrender, becomes public property by the doctrine of surrender.
But it's a surrender of public highway or trail. Why wasn't there a surrender of the trail and not the wall?
You know, Your Honor.
In fact, if you think about what Justice McKenna is asking, mm-hmm. too, if you're paying the taxes for the land under the wall, I mean, I think the argument is viable, at least for me, on the maintenance of the trail. But when we start saying that the entire wall has been assumed by the state, that is a different proposition. I don't see anything either, and I would almost think that you've admitted it by your pleadings, by not taking the position that the, because if your argument had been in your pleadings, look, the state owns the wall entirely, that's one thing, but you've never argued that. And it just seems to me that it's a whole different proposition to say, and in terms of maintenance and care, the pricing might be completely different.
It didn't stop them in the past, Your Honor. After Hurricane Iniki, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars repairing their wall.
But
they knew it was their wall.
But if you look at the justifications for why they maintained it, those documents seem to indicate they're talking about the trail.
Well, Mr. Weatherwax claimed that they had an easement over the wall. That's why the Department of Transportation.
Right, but he never says anything about owning it.
He didn't say that. But the reason.
Did any of those documents? I don't remember seeing any of the documents that you utilized for the J exhibit.
Yeah.
Said that the state owned the walls.
They didn't admit it. What they admitted was they had an easement over and a right and an obligation to fix it, which they did many, many times from 75 to 2006.
But actually, though, the state's complaint wanted a declaratory ruling that the state did not own the seawall. So the judge's conclusion is actually consistent with what the state was requesting. And she ruled that, yeah.
She rejected that.
She rejected that, right.
Right.
Mr. Klein, could you address the argument of that this decision, if it goes the way that you're arguing for, could open up unpredictable and perhaps very significant areas of liability for the state and in portions of the state that we may not even know about, where there could be conditions existing that it could be argued that there's been an easement by prescription or surrender or implied dedication. Is that, what about this case sets it apart? Or perhaps that is the rule that you're arguing for. How can we predict how far this case will go in terms of what it would open up?
I don't think you can predict it, but given the fact that it's taken us 10 years to get here and there are very special facts involved in this case, it is a bit very factually based. So I think Judge Crandall had 100 and something facts. Very difficult to marshal a case like this into the future. You're doing nothing different if you accept the fact that implied dedication as a legal theory still exists. But as you saw in Banning, it's very difficult to meet the requirements. As far as surrender as another basis, surrender can occur, and in fact is deemed to occur. That's why you don't need reliance on the other three statutes, Mr. Weinhoff is positing that you do. But surrender requires, first of all, private owner of a wall, taking no acts of ownership for 5 years before that surrender turns what is private property into public property.
Couldn't there be untold numbers of properties around the state that could potentially satisfy that definition? And then if something occurs on one of those properties, the argument will be made that's now the state's land and the state is responsible.
And it happens all the time, Your Honor. I don't see it adding to the burden. I mean, it's the law. If the law goes in an unpredictable way, I think we're here for clarity.
But doesn't that then go against the legislature's? The legislature wants oceanfront or land recreational areas to be kept open.
Yes.
And your owners want the state to take this over, but there are a lot of owners that don't want that. And isn't this a ruling in affirming this decision going to cause a lot of landowners to start cutting off access instead? They're going to say, you know what? Man, we thought that we were protected by 520-7, but now the Supreme Court has said, you don't exercise ownership, you let people come. Nope, the state can take over not only an easement, but ownership. Therefore, we're going to start closing everything off.
Well,
I mean, it's happening already, isn't it? I mean, Kamehameha Ridge, you know, people used to go hiking and the owners closed it off. You can't go hiking up there anymore.
I think many owners would feel just like mine do.
I'm sorry?
I think many owners would feel just like mine do, which is if the state is going to people in the state are going to access a seawall, for example, for literally 80 years, then they should take responsibility for maintaining it, and they should actually, under legal principles, own it by surrender. Many owners don't want that liability. They don't want that responsibility.
Are you arguing, Mr. Weinhoff seems to be arguing that, you know, if the court upholds this ruling, then please limit it to the facts of this case, which is the 75, the Weatherwax AG opinion, the fact that all of these repairs were made by the state, because otherwise we're opening floodgates.
I can understand his position. I can understand it. I mean,
what is distinctive about this? Is the fact that the state repaired this property so many times important in that analysis to you, or is that not an important part of the analysis?
It is important that the state, through the DLNR, actually took the responsibility to fix this wall after Hurricane Iniki. These facts are all very important. And, you know, apropos to this case, I don't know how many other times the state DLNR has fixed this
wall. Do you really want to keep arguing Iniki? Because it seems to me that if you keep arguing the state repairing things after a natural disaster, it's going to discourage the state from taking any actions to help, you know, other For example, you know, you see on the news, like, there's some road, and it's not a county road, so the county's not going to fix it. Or, you know, it's a state, it's not really government property, but it's important to the community or whatever. Mm-hmm. If we say that after a hurricane, mm-hmm. because the state fixes something, mm-hmm. they're now claiming ownership of it, isn't that a dangerous position to be taken?
Not really. I mean, they're fixing their wall. I mean, in 1975, they had an easement over this.
So it's really the fact that it was repaired before Iniki that's really controlling for this case.
We don't only have repairs. We have people, we have negative declaration, we have statements saying the seawall, the state of Hawaii has a right-of-way. I mean, we have assertive statements like that. We have the legislature approving an appropriation.
Correct.
I mean, it looks like to me, I mean, I know adverse possession is usually done with physical structure, but what we have here is an open announcement and stating that, look, the state is exercising its ability and not only exercising its ability and appropriation, but actually going out there. And I'm quite certain that they didn't go talk to every single owner and said, oh, do we have approval for what we're going to do?
Correct.
But adverse possession or prescriptive easement requires some nature of hostility, correct? And you're saying that the owners wanted everybody to use it, so it's not hostile. In addition, the fact that you're asking for an easement to be recognized, how can that be hostile?
I think what we have is acceptance by the state, by the acts of repairs that they did over decades.
Correct. And you know, as far as a prescriptive easement is concerned, you know, the ICA didn't address that.
Right.
It was addressed by Judge Crandall. She felt she had to because of Banning. We don't need to find a prescriptive easement if we find a trail or an implied dedication of a right-of-way or surrender of a highway, all the other avenues, so to speak, to make the property the state's property. We don't need the prescriptive easement argument. We don't need to get into the nitty-gritty of what constitutes a prescriptive easement, although Judge Crandall did an admirable job and came out and said, yeah, here, state has a prescriptive easement. The state has admitted they have an easement. We already know that's an admission that they have an easement. Mr. Weatherwax so said. And I would also point out one other thing, Justice Pollack, as far as the state's involvement, I mean, I find it very ironic for Mr. Weinhoff to sit here and say, well, they charged us for an easement over the wall so we could affix a ladder so that people could go into the water. There's a keyhole off the ladder where you can access the ocean without having to scramble over the reef. There's a keyhole that couldn't be built now, but was built a long time ago, so people could enter the water from the ladder and go out and surf. Okay, so for Mr. Weinhoff to say, well, they charged us just for the face of where the ladder goes, incorrect. Not only did we have to pay for the easement, a couple thousand dollars a year, we also had to insure it with them as additionally insured. Why? Because they're the owner. So you have many of these instances.
Was this the wall, that portion of the wall that they built?
This is their wall.
No, the portion that they concede that they built, the DHA wall. Is this a different wall?
No, it's not a portion of the wall they built. It's a portion of the wall in front of the Diamond Head Apartments.
And that they concede that they actually built it, right?
We claim that it's their wall. But the finding that Judge Crandall made was there's one seawall and it was built by private parties. That's what she made. It's uncontested.
But on appeal, it seems to be that, I guess, Diamond Head Apartments came in and said, no, wait a minute, the state built it. And then the state, in reply, said, yes, we concede that we built that portion of the wall.
The state repaired. They never built a wall. They built a cantilevered walkway with railings as an improvement to their wall.
Okay.
Mr. Klein, I'm sorry. I think Justice Nakayama had a question.
Yeah, you know, I have a question. I know they said it's one wall, but as you know, some of it is walkable and some of it is not.
Yes.
And Justice Pollack talks about, at some point in time, it becomes, it's not a trail, clearly not a trail anymore. It's 6 feet above the water. So at what point do you concede that part of it is a trail and part of it is not?
It's a trail. I mean, it's not lots of trails are difficult to traverse.
Well, nobody, those ones that are 6 feet high with the trees growing over it, nobody traverses those. I mean,
on the contrary, the findings of facts in this case show that people traverse it every day. It's dangerous because part of the top of it is, of the trail is worn off. And, you know, people take their surfboards and they go through it. It's in the findings of facts that are uncontested. I keep coming back to that because I think this court has to, as it always does, if findings of facts are not contested, accept the findings of the fact that the trier of fact made. And you look at those, they're all in our favor. They're all in our favor. The only thing Mr. Weinhoff has asked this court to do is say, let's accept all of that, but please put another gloss on state ownership of trails, walkways, right-of-ways, highways, whatever you want to say, public walkways, that the state has to consent. They don't want property foisted off on them. They need consent, and the three statutes allow that consent. That's all that he's arguing. And I would say, it's not that this wall was a stranger to the state. They have history from 75 to 2006, so to say it being foisted off on them, I think is a little over the top. They knew about this wall, they fixed it many times, and they did so because they realized it was either their wall or they had an easement for public access for many years, probably from the 30s, that made it their responsibility.
Mr. Klein, could you address the attorney's fees issue? And again, my understanding, Mr. Weinhoff's argument is that the fact, or he would disagree with the ICA's conclusion that by filing suit, the state waived its sovereign immunity. What's your take on that?
My take on that is this, the case that we cited, which is Unzai, which we put in our brief. In Unzai, that's exactly what it says, and that's what the ICA said. If you sue us, the doctrine of sovereign immunity doesn't even come into play. It's not a question of waiver.
Isn't there a difference between suing for damages and suing for declaratory relief and asking for a legal opinion? Shouldn't the state be able to ask the court for a legal declaration without waiving sovereign immunity?
Maybe so, but that's not what the case says. Anzai says if you sue, if you file a lawsuit, then that filing doesn't even implicate sovereign immunity. It's not a question of waiving it. This is a perfect case of which attorney's fees should be paid because the plaintiffs in this case are seeking to uphold the right of public access that's been going on there for years and years and years. And that gets into the private attorney general doctrine, which it's confusing to me that you could satisfy all three elements of the private attorney general doctrine and the answer to your position would be, well, the state is immunity and can't be sued. That's why this case is special, because it falls under Anzai because they made the concerned effort or concerted effort to file their own lawsuit for their own reasons instead of just answering our complaint and raising defenses to our complaint.
What public interest is vindicated by your suit?
Well, public access is vindicated.
Whether you win or lose, public access is still there. So you're not fighting for public access. Basically, you're fighting to be relieved of liability. So what is the public, how is the public going to, the broad public going to benefit from this?
I'm not dodging this question, but I think I've answered it, public access. But the only thing Judge Crandall said was, I'm not getting into that, sovereign immunity applies. So what we addressed is why sovereign immunity doesn't apply. And the ICA said, okay, sovereign immunity doesn't apply. They cited Anzai, which was our position, and then they wanted to return the case back to Judge Crandall to determine whether the three elements of the PAG doctrine applied. So I think I'd like to defer that to explain it once again to Judge Crandall, who had that full explication of the PAG doctrine, but just said, well, sovereign immunity. So we don't think sovereign immunity applies when you file a lawsuit, and it's waived. Not even waived. It doesn't apply. I'm sorry, I've gone way over.
No. Anything to wrap up, Mr. Klein?
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you very much. Mr. Weinhoff, you can have some brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I made a bunch of notes, and so there's some points that I was going to address, but of course I'll welcome and undoubtedly will get questions. With respect to where, oh, yes, Your Honor.
Before you go on, the argument just was that because the state filed a suit, that therefore the sovereign immunity would be waived. But your suit was dismissed, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
They prevailed on their suit, not your suit.
Yeah, I think the order says my lawsuit was dismissed. I believe that's what the order
says. Your lawsuit was dismissed? Does that mean that all the owners are not a part of the case?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I guess I would say, in all fairness, my understanding of the order was that they won on their suit, which necessarily meant we lost on our suit, so the court just simply dismissed our lawsuit. I didn't read it to say that, you know, they never were parties or that that case wasn't tried. So my honest answer would be the fact that it was dismissed is not part of my argument that we're not entitled to private attorney general doctrine. I'm sorry.
But if it's dismissed also, then your lawsuit was the only one that brought up ownership. They just asked that the state be responsible for maintenance and care.
That's true. That's true.
I mean, what does the final judgment say?
I don't have it right in my hand, but I'm pretty sure it says that I know what it says is that they have a prescriptive easement over the walls, and they own the walls to the extent they're not in the land court jurisdiction. And then it goes on to say that the state's lawsuit is dismissed. I believe that's what it says in terms.
After the trial, and after the case was consolidated, and after the trial.
After the trial.
And adjudicated.
Right. That was just part of the order, part of the final judgment.
Okay.
I have the findings right in front of me. I'll turn to the last page. So, yeah, it says the state's claim for declaratory judgment in the other civil number is dismissed, and I'm sure the judgment said the exact same thing. That was part of the findings and conclusions.
So, so the only parties here is the parties in the complaint, their complaint, GCNA?
Well, they were parties at the time that we tried the case. So I guess I would think my honest answer to the case is, to your question is no. That's what I believe, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Say that again, they're not.
No, I think they are parties.
Oh.
I think they were parties at trial, that's for sure. And the fact that the case that I brought against them was dismissed, that does not suggest to me that they weren't parties to the case and are not parties now. That's what I would honestly say. All
right. But I thought their only claim for relief was requesting a finding that the state had a duty to maintain and repair.
I would say you are absolutely right, Your Honor, and I would say that I was puzzled, as I pointed out throughout.
The judgment needs to be on your complaint.
That I do agree with. The judge, with all due respect, gave them something that they did not ask for and did not give them what they asked for. So I always found that very troubling. I repeatedly pointed it out to the courts. And, with all due respect, judges do what they do. And all I can say is I tried to make that argument.
But you actually filed a complaint asking on the declaration of ownership, too.
I did. You're right, Your Honor.
But in any event, this is beyond what the plaintiffs have asked for. And it just seems to me, it just appears right out of the blue at the end, because the analysis is pretty much all the way through about what establishes a right-of-way.
That's true.
Not the ownership of the wall itself and the land underneath.
The first thing that I wrote in this case was, this is an exceedingly odd case. That was the very first sentence of the very first thing that I filed, which was my motion for summary judgment. And I always thought it was an odd case, and I think it's odd, and I think we got an odd result because they asked for something, they didn't get that, they didn't ask for something else, and they did get that. So with respect to that, I can't.
The reality is that this island is eroding.
I beg your pardon?
The reality is that this island is eroding.
Right.
And so shorelines are increasingly going to become makekai. I mean, the shoreline is going to keep moving. Well, I guess some places it might expand, but some places it's just going to move in.
Yeah, actually I have a bunch of other cases about this. An individual named Chip Fletcher from the university has a study of the whole island. And short answer, yes, they're typically moving back. There's some that are retreating, but mostly moving back.
Right. So to the extent that it's moving back, under our law, the state owns the property up until the reaches of the waves, correct, or whatever the specific language is,
That's
correct?
Right. Yes.
So portions of the seawall are in that?
Portions of the seawall, that also is in Exhibit J24, and we talked about it. Portions.
Right.
So there's a number of lines that are relevant here, Your Honor. Your Honor and I already had a dialogue about the meets and bounds. But the meets and bounds, as you know, and your precedents very clearly say, they don't set anything in stone. The ownership line is the highest wash of the waves, or I know I didn't say
so
that.
So as a practical matter, the state does own at least some of the land under this seawall.
Exactly. And that's in the record. And so my point has been that these walls they're encroaching onto my paradigm is their walls are encroaching on our property. That happens all over the island, everywhere. There's thousands of them, and I'll say hundreds because then I know I'm not exaggerating. And typically what happens is we get an encroachment agreement, and the encroachment agreement, it says, you guys promise, it's your wall, you're encroaching, you promise to maintain it, you promise to indemnify us if there's any issues with it. That's what typically happens. In this case, they chose to take the position that it's our wall for different reasons. I admit that it's not the same, but the typical response is when you have an encroachment, then the owners fess up to encroaching. And I admit it's different here. I'm not trying to argue it's not different. But you're absolutely right. It happens all over the islands.
And so there is no encroachment agreement in this? There was no prior encroachment agreement in this case?
Your Honor, I believe it was Justice McKenna that had asked me about where the trails go and where they come in. The diagram that I showed you is in the findings of fact as part of finding fact 55. It is not highlighted, however. The question of where you get to the walls, finding fact 54 says there is no record access from the street to the property. I believe the dialogue was, and this is in fact absolutely correct, that people have typically walked over a piece of land court property that they do not and cannot have any legal rights to walk over, but nobody has ever stopped them. So what's the effect of that? I don't know. The fact of the matter is there's no legal access from the street to the walls. The only physical way to get there, one and only one, is to walk over this land court piece of property. That's just a fact. With respect to banning, Mr. Klein correctly points out that in banning, no argument was made about those three other statutes. The reason is that in banning, it was the state that filed the lawsuit, and so I think it can be safely presumed. We do not know from the facts of banning, but I think we can safely presume that both the Board of Land and Natural Resources and the Attorney General authorized that lawsuit and therefore exercised their authority under these other three statutes. With respect to the other three statutes, I'd like to just say one last time.
Does your deck action that you filed authorize, does that cure their problem? I mean, I'm not sure I understand the distinction.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the argument was made, and correctly so, that in banning, the state didn't argue you have to comply with these other three statutes. Well, it's because the state itself instituted that lawsuit. And therefore, I think we can presume, although we do not factually know, that the Attorney General authorized the lawsuit and that the Board of Land and Natural Resources authorized the lawsuit.
You mean to acquire accreted land?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. My suggestion with respect to the statutes is if you really ask yourself what is the actual legislative intent with respect to these four statutes, I submit that it's very clear that the statute is specifically intended to make sure that a thoughtful decision is made at the very top levels of the state, the Attorney General, and the Board of Land and Natural Resources. With respect to, I would also like to point out, I know there's cases that say things that people say in front of you at oral argument is taken very seriously. Mr. Klein said his clients want people to use the wall. That is the end of the issue with respect to prescriptive easements, as far as I'm concerned. And in fact, if you look at the findings with respect to the use of the wall that are at 86, et cetera, Mrs. Anderson, 86, says Mrs. Anderson has observed the public using the walkway. Fine, there's no dispute as to that. That's why I didn't dispute any of the facts. It's certainly not every day, and that wasn't any findings. To the best of her knowledge, no owner has ever attempted to block use. Mrs. Anderson has no knowledge of anyone exercising control. That's the end of the case with respect to prescriptive easement. There's no evidence that the use was not permissive. And so there you're left with the general law of prescriptive easement is every intendment is taken in favor of it being permissive.
So in terms of the argument that the private attorney general doctrine applies because the purpose of this lawsuit was to ensure public access, since there's no, your argument is that since the owners are not opposing public access, the only real benefit is to the private property owners here.
Well, yes. I mean, that's true. I would say the argument that I was making actually went to whether it's prescriptive easement. But the point that you made is also exactly correct. I mean, the whole point is there's been access for 80 years that nobody ever challenged. Now that we own this, the wall, I mean, there's going to be some, if we do own the wall, there's going to be some real issues as to whether we take it down or don't take it down or block it or whatever. With respect to
Before you leave that, that came out of an ICA case or something that cited the permissive use. I took a look at that, the
yes,
case
sir.
That they cite. And it's I think it's about 100 years old. It's from the Jarrett
case. No, the case that I believe that I cited that from is, I'm pretty sure it's Ross versus Tanabe, Your Honor. It's an
right,
ICA case.
And that
it's certainly not 100 years old.
No, but it cites based on the Jarrett case, I believe.
Well, I don't have the etymology of that at my fingertips, but I feel very confident that I'm correctly quoting the law, Your Honor, because that is. Adverse possession and prescriptive easements are disfavored in the law and by this court, and this court has been very clear to say that every intendment is against that type of thing. So I feel very confident that I'm quoting that law correctly. And I'm also very confident that quoting it from Jones is incomplete and unbinding.
But your position would be that then continuous use by the public will never establish a prescriptive easement. That's basically if it's
permissive, yes.
Okay, well, there's a lot of law, including the restatement of property third, that doesn't buy into that, as you probably know. And additionally, the case that's relied upon from NLY, it was specifically a case where the owner had said to the individual who was using it, that's how they used the word permission. And that use of the word has been repeated through the cases. And I'm not sure it's an appropriate application of exactly what the facts are.
Well, Your Honor, I have to say that I'm not able to quote chapter and verse. I know that we'll all go back to our offices and look at this. I'm very confident that what I'm saying is correct, and I'm very confident, and I certainly could be wrong, but I will say that I'm very confident that when there is no evidence that the use is without permission, and in fact, we have a statement, and it was always undisputed that they were happy to have them use it, that it does not arise that there's a prescriptive easement.
I didn't see any argument on discussion of estoppel in the findings and the conclusions. Was that one of the issues raised by GACNA?
No, I don't believe so.
Mr. Weinhoff, I'm sorry, if you could begin to wind up your rebuttal,
yes.
I appreciate it.
I actually wanted to, with respect to significant liabilities going forward, perhaps members of this court read in the newspaper not too long ago that there was a road out in Kahului where people were not, yeah, Kahului, I believe. Anyway, windward side where people are unable to get their garbage to go through. There are hundreds of roads all over this island that are in private ownership where they've been abandoned by developers or other things have come up where the people have never stopped other people from using it. Each and every one of those roads is a potential liability, a potential albatross around the neck of either the state or less likely the county, I suppose, since they have the right to say no. With respect, Justice McKenna, to your argument, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say this, your questions about Chapter 520, in all honesty and fairness, I would like to say this. That was something that we were aware of and that we had pointed out to Judge Crandall, and Judge Crandall, I believe in her findings, made clear that Chapter 520 was passed in 1969. And so I believe that we said, to the extent there was this use after 1969, it couldn't possibly, no matter what, give rise to this use. And Judge Crandall, I believe in her findings, does try to address the issue of there was use before Chapter 520 was passed. So I just, in all honesty, I wanted to make sure that I said that. With respect to the sea ladder, I would just like to say one more time, the sea ladder is discussed at finding of fact 109. And what it says is it is an easement or rights over submerged land. And submerged land is not the wall. It's the submerged land Mackay of the wall. We gave them the right to walk into the submerged land Mackay of the wall. We insisted, as we usually do with agreements like this, that they defend and indemnify us and obtain insurance. That has literally nothing to do with the outcome of this case.
I understand that there was some reference to a quitclaim deed that refers to some sort of right-of-way or easement or something like that. And was that ever clarified as that was?
No, Your Honor. And let me just say one more thing, if I might, Justice Pollack. There was one of the walls, and it's in the findings somewhere, and I apologize that I don't know, that we did have actually have an easement over one of the walls, a recorded easement over one of the walls. And finally, let me just say this, the wall that we built and that I talked about in response to Justice Pollack was not the wall to which the C letter was attached,
Thank
to
you.
The best of my recollection.
Okay, talking about that ladder, didn't you grant an easement for 55 years for the privilege and authority to construct, use, maintain, and repair a ladder?
No.
In 2003?
Let me see what it says. I'm hoping the answer is going to be no, no.
It's finding 109.
I see it. Well, I mean, it says what it says. You can look at the thing. I guess I should have objected to this thing because that's not correct. It's not a correct interpretation of the document that's in the record. But I admit that it does say that.
The document refers to submerged?
Yes. It's quoted in 109. It talks about being a portion of the submerged land to the extent that the finding says.
Give authority to construct the ladder?
No. We gave them. Okay, so here's what I remember about it, Your Honor. So, I mean, the finding says what it says. What happened is that ladder was on the wall for quite a while and it fell off. Okay, and then so the GCNA wanted to put it back on there. And to the best of my recollection, we said it's not our wall. We don't care if you put it back on there. You can get an easement for the submerged land, which is what we gave them. That is the best of my recollection, Your Honor. I see what the finding of fact says, and if the court wanted to go back, it could also. I'm sure that document was in the record as an exhibit. But I don't know what exactly it was. But I see what it says, and what it says is inconsistent with my recollection of the case, but the finding says what it says, and is binding because I didn't challenge it. I admit that.
Very well, Mr. Weinhoff. Anything further at this time?
Your Honor, thank you very
Any
much.
Further requests by court?
Attention,
thank you very much, Mr. Weinhoff and Mr. Klein. The court will take this matter under advisement.